Hello and welcome to episode 3.10, the February 7th, 2024, two-thirds edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. My usual format on this podcast is to present three interviews covering three different events in the region, and ever since I've started the podcast, I've had no difficulty getting three guests to discuss their events with me. Until now. For a number of reasons too convoluted to get into here, this podcast only has two interviews instead of my usual three. I'm not too worried about that, however, as both my guests are engaging personalities and have exciting events to talk about. It's also kind of appropriate, too, since February is the month that is short the usual amount of days, even though this leap year we do get one extra one. So, in honor of February, the shortest month of the year, here's one of the shortest podcasts I've ever produced. So let's get into it.
Ця москальня, казавши гу, на парад Київ йде, любим сусідам руський мір принесе. Нє, Владимир, нє, Владимир, брешеш ти усьому світу, що ти за мір.
Нє, Владимир, нє, Владимир, брешеш ти усьому світу, що ти за мір.
Десь у поля. The Russian invasion of Ukraine is now close to 2 years old, with no real signs of peace in sight. President Zelensky continues to seek aid for his struggling country, and one of Fredonia's citizens answered that call for aid, but in a very unusual manner. Local photographer Patrick Stokes spent 5 weeks in Ukraine last year as a volunteer serving pizzas from a mobile pizza truck. On Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m., Patrick will be giving a presentation at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House about his experiences, sharing photographs, video, and stories from his time there. I spoke with Patrick to get a preview on his presentation. With me now is local photographer Patrick Stokes, and Patrick has a very interesting story to tell us. He was a volunteer over in Ukraine for 5 weeks. He took a lot of photos and had a tremendous experience, and he'll be sharing that experience at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Thursday, February 15th, beginning at 7 p.m. Admission to the event will be free, but donations will always be gratefully accepted. So, Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good. So let's start a little bit maybe from the beginning, and we'll work our way up to the presentation, because I want to make sure that I give the listeners enough information that they become interested, but not so much that they feel they've heard the presentation already. So that's a fine line to cross. You who have a reputation as a local photographer, you've exhibited in a couple of places in the region. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit just about where you got your interest in photography to begin with.
Yeah, in high school, I was part of the yearbook staff and took the photography courses in high school. My mom was an art teacher. She's a retired art teacher. So things sort of evolved from there. And, you know, on and off over the years, college, I picked up the camera again. Then post-college, kind of reality and job career hit. So the camera wasn't as important, or I wasn't involved in that as much. And then I moved, when I picked up a digital camera in 2001. That was my first digital camera. And on a go, you know, I kind of knew where it was going, but it wasn't where I wanted it to be yet. I wasn't a fan of film processing and dark rooms and all that. And especially if you work in color, then you have to hand over a lot of control. And then Photoshop was existing, so you're doing a lot of computer. So anyway, it evolved and evolved in the last few years. I picked up the camera, got really serious again, and I have some friends who work for Sony. One of them is the head project leader of the Sony Alpha Female program, which is a huge program that actually helps and supports any Sony photographer and gives them a leg up in the industry and helps them out with grants. Anyway, everything kind of evolved. So I use a Sony camera. So a little plug for them. But I just started, you know, redefining what I wanted photography to be in my life, kind of a career change. I kind of gig economy now. I do multiple things. However, that's kind of like the short answer of how I evolved into it. Then I joined the Art Trail and had my first exhibition at the local Darwin Barker Library, which I'm a member of the board there. So as you talked to Thomas Janik the other week, he still has his display up of his amazing work. So I have had a lot of good mentors around me, like Tom Janik, Jamie Hogard, and then a bunch that I went to school with, like Mark Mulville. He shot for the Buffalo News for 25 years, and Dave McLean, another local resident who worked for Nat Geo and others like that. So I've had some really good role models and mentors in my life, and kind of I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, but that's kind of how my photography is evolving. So a little quick plug, the good news is, speaking of the North Shore Arts Alliance, I want to talk about that later.
After. Okay. North Shore Arts Alliance. Got it. Okay. So I'll just comment a little bit and ask you, there are a lot of pictures from Point Gratchett Park, which is one of my favorite places in the region. It's a great sunset location, and you've taken a number of them, and you have this technique of putting the sun right in the middle of some kind of object. Where did you get that, that idea for?
Oh, you know, it's, you know, composition, I grew up like kind of intuitively learning composition from my mom. You know, I was, I'm gonna refer back to her again. I was given coloring books, but blanks. I mean, my friends had like Star Wars coloring books, and they could color in the X-Wings and the Death Stars. And I said, I want that. My mom would go out and get me a blank one. She's like, draw your own X-Wing. So I learned, you know, the rule of thirds and composition and breaking it. So, and it's always about changing perspective. A lot of folks go, I could never, you know, oh, how you, yeah, it's like literally it's like 3 feet difference between like eye level to getting down on the ground, or just spotting something unique on the ground, or something that's catching the light. You know, it's photography is all about just trying to get the light right. And so, yeah, and Point Gratchett has been kind of my muse. I've been doing a study of it for at least about 3 or 4 years now, and regularly taking quite a few photographs. I'm not, you know, more focused on this right now, but I'm still taking photographs down there, and hoping the ice hummocks do a little bit something more again, so I can get some good shots. But yeah, Point Gratchett, a lot of those are taken probably within 100, 200 yards, but it seems like they're miles away. The light here is quite unique. I know Tom Janik talked about it.
He did. And,
having traveled to, you know, I noticed like when I'd go down south and go to like a place like Key West, where they're famous for their sunsets, it was kind of meh, because there's so much atmosphere on the ocean. You get some, you know, if it's clear, but there's so much humidity and other thing factors. And what we have is this unique reflecting pond that's Point Gratchett. So Canada giveth and taketh away, kind of like we could have a cloudy day all day, but if there's an opening on the other side of the lake, we get that 5-6 minute of spectacular red blast glow of underlit clouds. And it's incredibly unique because the clouds hang on the lake a lot. So you have a better chance, and the atmosphere is much more clear, except when the fires are happening, which created, I've got tons of unique photographs from that this year, which was amazing. It's a big red filter kind of thing, and created some new photographs I haven't even published yet because I took so many of them. But we're very fortunate. Like we talked about, Tom, I'm going to keep referencing that podcast. The area, it's people see my pictures and think I'm taking pictures in some foreign Californian pristine. But, and I said, no, this is my backyard. I go, you really just, I mean, if you sit there on our beach and look, you're like, wow, you know, it's, I've noticed over the years, more and more people are starting to gravitate towards the sunsets, because I'll get down there early, start taking photos. I'll be so engrossed. I'll look up and there'll be, you know, 150 people on the beach, strung down the beach all of a sudden. And you'll notice in my on my Instagram that I capture that sometimes. I turn the camera on the beachgoers and do these really fun long shots of just rows and rows of people kind of reflecting off, skipping stones, you know, couples holding hands and things like that. And just people sitting there contemplating the sunset and enjoying a moment. We're very fortunate to have access to this.
Yes. Yes. I have to agree with you. I think it's a wonderful place and we're fortunate to live here. Now let's turn a little bit to your experience at Ukraine and the upcoming lecture. You spent 5 weeks over there with the volunteer group. Give us sort of the overall background of what your experience was, who you worked with and so on.
Yeah. And a lot of the stuff we'll go over here. You know, I have two kind of, I'm practicing my set for over there. So I know what to information here. So Siobhan's Trust is who I ended up volunteering with. Siobhan was a she was married to now the she's passed away. So Siobhan is from Scotland, England, and she was part of, you know, a fairly affluent family, and she became ill and she passed away from cancer. And her dying wish to her husband, David, who is the manages the trust now, or is in charge of the trust. She wanted her, you know, lifelong savings to go to good. So, and that wasn't too long before Ukraine started. So things were in motion. A family friend of theirs decided to go to the border during the escalation. During 2 years ago, we're almost at the 2 year anniversary now. And they went to the border just to help people out. They decided that pizzas were the most efficient way to feed people. And it really kind of organically grew. They didn't know that they were going to go and serve pizzas, Siobhan's Trust. So this is all about kind of, when I say Siobhan's Trust, I'm saying it like I know, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, she's our guardian angel, so to speak. We know her, but don't know her. We know her history. We know her family and friends. But that's the they call it NGO, non-government organization. It's called Siobhan's Trust. So I always say Siobhan. I talk about her in the first person a lot. And I was supposed to originally go over there with another NGO, and they came under attack one day and lost their leadership. The woman's name was Emma, and I had been in contact with her for about 6 months getting ready to go over. And she was killed along with she's a Spanish national, killed along with a Canadian, and an Austrian and a German were severely injured. And so that caused their NGO to have to shut down and regroup. And I don't, to this day, I kind of keep in touch with one of them, and they're still not back up and running, but they diverted their resources to another NGO. So I ended up with Siobhan's Trust, and, you know, they developed into what they are now, is they have two units traveling across, when I say units, multiple trucks traveling across Ukraine. One is based out of Lviv, so it kind of, one of the units serving pizzas is kind of wheels out like a spoke from Lviv as the home base. And the one that I ended up with was out east, and we're a wandering nomadic tribe from city to city and from village to village. And so it's serving, it's kind of, we were creating the vision that Siobhan's Trust had is creating like a distraction, a pizza party, and also to let them know that the world hasn't forgotten them, though they may feel that way. We just want to let them know, you know, we're out there doing what we can to help change a little bit of their day.
And what kind of reactions do those pizza trucks get when they show up into town and they start serving pizza to the local residents? I mean, what did you experience as the people came to grab a pizza?
Yeah, I got to experience everything. That was pretty amazing. Some of the places we went to, Siobhan's Trust had been before. So I'll give you both experiences. And, you know, we would have kids on bicycles following our trucks in to these small villages sometimes. You know, people would be lining the road. We could see people traveling to the spot, the square, or whatever, where we were going to set up. So we always kind of had a clue of when we were getting close to where we needed to be. It's sometimes greeted with more smiles than others. We were dealing and we weren't, you know, and it wasn't that, you know, they're not smiling because they're not happy to see us. We're talking about folks. IDPs is a word you'll hear that we say a lot, is internally displaced persons. So a lot of the folks in the villages, had to go hundreds of miles from their hometowns, and you know, they're trying to reestablish their life. And so we'd get so many different reactions, and it was just so, you know, you'd look at the faces, and our job was always to be, you know, we always had to have a good day. We always had to be smiling. We had to make a lot of eye contact. You know, I was trying to learn enough phrases in Ukrainian, but I always wore on my hat American, a half Ukrainian and half American flag. And then we would explain where we were all from: Germany, England, Norway. We occasionally would have some Ukrainian volunteers if we didn't have enough of our own volunteers. But the people, you know, always greeted us in such a warm, it was really overwhelming, especially obviously the kids. You know, they hit you differently when you know that they have so little. Mm-hmm. And they're just happy, and they're just, you know, grabbing pizzas and goofing around and getting to be like, we're there to create a pizza party and create just like for 6-7 hours, people would just come and hang out there for 6 or 7 hours and eat pizza, and some would help clean up. Now the other places where we were coming in new, you could always, you know, there's always like sometimes we come in massive crowds waiting for us. And, you know, sometimes these pizzas, you know, we would give them extra pizzas, and we knew that was like, and the reality of it, we were always trying to give we delivered cooked pizzas. And that was another key thing. A lot of these people that are displaced don't have ovens that are big enough to cook pizzas or reliable heat sources. And so for them, you know, they might be able to take a few of those pizzas home and keep themselves out of a stressful situation for a few days. So, and then we did some city centers, and that's when you really have like the big populations come out. Those are, you know, you have a couple thousand people waiting in line, and, you know, it really, you know, you can feel the tension amongst the volunteers, like, here we go, because we're just, but it's amazing how the volunteers all just, you know, once, you know, you look at, you know, you see the faces waiting, and it just absolutely energizes you every day.
And you took many pictures while you were out there, obviously. I think literally thousands of pictures. What did you find was most compelling to train your camera towards as you were delivering these pizzas? What generally compelled you to say, I need a shot of that? I need a shot of that.
Oh, God, for every picture I took, there's, you know, another 500 that I couldn't, because I was serving pizzas. And I made a very big distinction when I was there. It's the photography comes second, third, fourth. You know, obviously serving the Ukrainians comes first. You know, supporting my volunteers at all costs, you know, being a good team member was a big part of it. But when I, you know, as I got into it more, I was able to find, you know, it depended on how many volunteers we had too. To give you we usually operate with, the trust usually operates with about 8 people-ish, on 8 to 12, to maintain a really good flow. And for a week, we were down to four of us.
Mm.
So we were relying on pulling in volunteers from the crowd. And we were serving as many people with four of us as we were with 10 of us. So we got to be a very tight unit for a week. So I didn't take as many pictures that week. But then when volunteers started flowing, so what I've trained my cameras on is just the interaction a lot between the volunteers and the Ukrainians that were coming in, especially the kids, but trying to just catch, catching some faces, some moments. So much was going on so quickly. The weather would really cooperate with us, but I was always just, sometimes during the day, I'd always try to get a portrait or two of someone who was there. Like you'd just see either an older gentleman or some kids were just there all day. So I'd bring them up and I'd get like a really nice portraiture of them to kind of bring that intimacy with, they're just like us. It was so funny because they were wearing, some of the kids were wearing Star Wars t-shirts and I had one on, and this kind of hits you hard because you're at an orphanage. And I was trying to speak and never seen Star Wars. They were just receiving the clothing from the United States and other places in relief. And he had no idea. And then you realize there's maybe two TVs in the orphanage when we got the tour. So every day it's a much different, culture shock. You kind of just think everybody knows these pop culture things. Not a lot of Ukrainians speak English. It's not broadly taught. The ones who do speak English, obviously, it seems like, it's kind of like they have a leg up. And a lot of the kids are learning it through streaming apps, we found out, because their English would be very good. And where'd you learn this? They said Netflix.
Wow.
So but yeah, training my camera, like it evolved, because I would see group, there's so much, from the landscape, the field, that by that time all the fields of sunflowers were dead and hadn't been harvested yet, so they were more blackish brownish, but you could just look and imagine like these massive fields, like going through Kansas, and you really get a feel. So I it was almost, there are times when I had a lot of FOMO, I was missing out, but in the other end, it was like, I'm taking it in and I know I'll get a lot of amazing captures and wait for the right moments. And towards the end, when the crew started to build up and we had more volunteers, especially my last three or four days, I said, I'm going to slack off a lot and I'm going to take a lot of pictures. And they're laughing. They're like, you slack off. I was always, me and my buddies were the first ones up in the morning, and we were the last ones cleaning up. We always wanted to make sure we showed our appreciation to Siobhan's Trust for allowing us to join them as well.
I have maybe one more question to ask you about this, and I think for me it's this idea that we tend to think of, especially in this country, as war is kind of an abstract idea because we never experience it on our own territory. But you went over to a place where it's actually happening on the ground. So for you, what do you think was the perhaps most interesting thing you came to realize or learn about what happens on the ground in a country where there is a war actually taking place there?
Yeah, that was, going when I initially went over, your mind's reeling, why are you doing this? How'd this happen? These are a lot of things I'll talk about at the Opera House. And the reality of it is surreal once you get there. The Ukrainians have been fighting this since 2014 when Crimea was invaded. So they've been at a state of war since 2014 in their mind. We look at it 2 years. No, the big problem is, how it's being portrayed in one sense, or being actually like talked about media wise and covered. And it is, 2 years ago is when the Ukrainians really refer to it as the full-scale invasion happened, but the war, they said the war has escalated. So when you're over there, they've been in a state of war since 2014 under threat. So you could see, you know, there's PTSD, but there's also, it's surreal when you're in the city. Sometimes you're in places and, you know, you don't feel the effects of war. You don't, you know, there, you know, it's almost like there's an escapism. Everybody in the Soviet era blockhouses that are everywhere, the parks are always full. Even when the air raid sirens go off, it's almost like I watched, you know, one lady look up to the sky and throw up the one fingered salute, and you could hear some reference to Putin. So, you know, being there and asking, talking to them directly, and you know, I met a lot of soldiers. And I befriended a couple of them, and one of them, he's a 22-year-old, and I don't demand, but they'll send like a plus sign every week. You know, he'll send a plus sign. That means okay, can't talk. And then he'll send me a picture of him with his unit in the middle of the night with, you know, and then all of a sudden it was like, who are they? And it was like, we just captured three Russians yesterday, and this is them. And you know, and he'll send video. And, you know, so, you know, you have this, I met him, he was skateboarding in a park. So I'm getting back to the park. So people are in the park, he was on leave. And you know, life is going on, but obviously a severe tension. The kids there are amazing, but you can see how they talk and it affects them. And you can't imagine, you know, we cannot imagine. We're very, you know, and that's what it's surreal. It really comes down to surreal. And it's such a hard question to answer because, you know, you're over there and, you know, but the signs of war are everywhere. So that's a good segue is, you know, you can walk out of the store, but then you look down and all the big giant tank traps are everywhere at every intersections. Every day that we traveled, we went through multiple checkpoints. And these are hardcore checkpoints. We're talking, you know, manned by 20 heavily armed, you know, military men and women. They're female. I think it's about 20-30% of the army are female. And, you know, they'd be, you know, there's always like, no matter, we know what we were doing, but there's always like that, you're going through these checkpoints and it really hits you. You know, occasionally you get stopped and checked out, you know, you'd always have your papers. We always have. So the realities of war also came down to, we always had a bug out bag. We never left anything in our rooms that we were worried about not having with us, especially our papers and everything. So if something suddenly happened and we couldn't go back to our hotel and we had to flee west, you know, so every day, like the war is ever present in everything you do. You know, the curfews are there. So, you know, you don't go out after 10 p.m. You can't go out after 10 p.m. Well, if you do, you're going to. Or I also learned when I was picking up some of our volunteers at the train stations in the morning, I'd drive down before 8 a.m. or before like 7 a.m. All the street lights are off. Most of the street lights are off. And and that also means the traffic lights aren't on. So it's a really weird, it's a surreal experience because am I here? What am I doing here? My family and friends were all like, you know, stay safe, stay in the West. I stayed in the West for about 5 minutes. And then I was like, no, can't stay here. I've got to go East. And that's another story. But every moment it was kind of, you contemplated it and it really, like the air raids would go off constantly. And, you know, the thing that we were told is you don't have to worry until it gets noisy. And so if you hear a thud, and one time we heard a thud, but it was at night after we were done. And I said, is that noisy? And they're like, no, noisy is thud, thud, thud. So I was like, okay.
Okay. So. Wow. Well, that's really amazing. I I do hope that audiences will come and see this to get your perspective. It's just such a unique perspective, especially in our region, to get someone who's been there to be able to talk to, you know, the residents of Northern Chautauqua County about what's going on over there. And I, before we finish here, I just want to circle back a little bit, because you did mention something about the North Shore Arts Alliance that you were going to pick up.
Yeah. You know, I've been part of that for quite a few years, and, you know, I'm going to be incorporating some of the images I took from Ukraine. Like, I'm going to have my local stuff, but I'm going to incorporate some pictures that I've handpicked out of them that I haven't published yet, that I feel have a really kind of encapsulates my journey there. And I'm going to be showing those. The Opera House is going to be, yeah, I'm going to have video presentations. I took a lot of video, a lot of time lapse, along with my photographs. I was kind of, you know, I became the de facto documenter there. A lot of the videos you'll see, they about 5 minutes before the first pizza got served, they'd notify me and they go, "Okay, time for Pat's walkabout," and I would run out into the crowd with the camera and video and fist bump the kids and get everybody kind of. It's coming, pizza, you know, you're there, you know, it's getting ready. The music's already started to play. So so it's a multimedia presentation, but getting back to the North Shore Arts Alliance, yeah, we're, you know, I always want to promote that. You know, it's helped me evolve to become the photographer I'm hoping to be someday. And this year, and hopefully I'll get to come back on again and talk to you about it. I'll be at a new hub that I'm leading at 21 Bricks has decided to come on.
Oh, and be good.
To be a major hub and promote us heavily. And that was a huge, huge win. And, you know, all these things are coming together, and it's been, I've been very fortunate. Getting back to the, presentation at the Opera House immediately following the Methodist Church just across the street. We're going to be doing a bit of a pizza party in the basement afterwards. So there'll be a little meet and greet aspect. So so we'll be able to come down there, and Om Nom Gluten Free is going to be supplying gluten-free pizzas. And we'll probably have to supplement a few pizzas from some local establishments. I haven't pinned down them yet, but we'll have a few extra pizzas. I'll have some of the items that I collected along the way from a lot of drawing. The kids would just hand you stuff, drawings, little, you know, they would, it was just, those were the most, you know, some of the most overwhelming moments were the kids when they would come up and they would draw, like you could see them drawing stuff, and they would come up to the volunteers and they would hand us little drawings that they had just made, or they would, you know, little bracelets they had made, other things like that. It was, you know, and they, you know, you realize they have nothing. So, you know, even for them to give up a piece of paper is,
wow,
is huge. So.
Yes. And I also think this, people who want to, you'll probably mention this at the presentation too, but they can support Siobhan's Trust.
Yeah. Thank you. Should have led with that. Siobhan's Trust. I'll have links and stuff for you to their website to donate directly. Obviously, I'm going to do a direct fundraiser there. So whoever wants to donate there in any way, shape or form, they can. I've also been helping Siobhan's Trust with finding volunteers. So I've been approached by folks. So if anybody's looking and has some time to volunteer, you know, I can explain to them how to, you know, it's a, you know, actually the most stressful part of my whole experience was getting there. Cause I, you know, I landed in, and that's a whole nother story I'll talk about, but you know, once you're in country and you're there, it's like, okay, I'm here. And kind of like, once you can put your bag down and get a night's sleep and recoup. But Siobhan's, yeah, I'll have the links to Siobhan's Trust and a couple more. I've sent you some podcasts that I listen to regularly, and they do a very good job of just reporting the day-to-days of what's going on there, interviewing Ukrainians, you know, people that are on the ground there. I think that's a huge, huge way of like getting really like detailed up to the minute what's going on there, what they need, and how the Ukrainian, you know, they're they've been, you know, if you look at their the short history of them, they've been through so many wars, so many conflicts. You know, everything really majorly started in 1920 after World War One, and you know, they've been beat up constantly ever since. So they're an incredibly resilient people. But as a nation, as Ukraine a nation, they've only been a nation for about 40 years since the breakup of the Soviet Union.
So Patrick, thank you very much. I'll make sure to get all of those links too in the show notes at the bottom of the podcast, the website, the podcast website. So you'll have, we'll have that as well. Thank you very much for sharing your experience with me. And again, let me encourage all my listeners to check your lecture out Thursday, February 15th, 7 o'clock at the Opera House. Good luck with it, Patrick.
Thank you so much. Oh, one more plug. I'll be on the Chadwick Bay Broadcasting System, WDOE and Kix on the 13th. February 13th at 7:30 a.m. They're going to do an interview of me there. So I'll be promoting the event at that time as well. So if everybody wants to tune into that, there's another way to hear some more preamble to the show.
Great. Great. Thank you, Patrick. Take care.
Thank you.
Ukraine in Crisis, A Volunteer's Perspective, will be presented at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Thursday, February 15th, beginning at 7 p.m. Admission is free. Donations gratefully accepted. A post-lecture pizza party will be held at the First Methodist Church following the lecture as a fundraiser for Siobhan's Trust. Here is the arts calendar for the next 2 weeks in the region. At the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, the cinema series will present the film The Color Purple, a musical adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Alice Walker. The film and novel tell the story of Celie Harris, an African-American woman living in the Deep South in the 1900s. The Color Purple screens on Saturday, February 10th and Tuesday, February 13th at 7:30 p.m. each night. Tickets are $6.50 and available at the door only the night of the screening. The cinema series is sponsored by Lakeshore Savings Bank. Also at the Opera House, the next Art and Architecture series will present the documentary The Immortals, The Wonders of the Museo Egizio. Narrated by Jeremy Irons, the documentary explores the Museo Egizio in Turin's vast collection of Egyptian art and artifacts from the age of the pharaohs. The Immortals will be screened on Saturday, February 17th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for students. Call the box office at 716-679-1891 for tickets and more information. At the SUNY Fredonia School of Music, the Robert Jordan Piano Festival will be held from February 13th through 14th. The festival features two alumni returning to campus. On Tuesday, February 13th, Lauren Sturm Sclafani, the chief stereo technician and lead sound engineer at Steinway & Sons, will give a presentation on the Steinway Stereo, a high-resolution player piano, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. in the Roush Recital Hall. On February 14th, Dr. John Patrick Murphy from the University of Oklahoma will give a lecture beginning at 4 p.m. entitled Piano Pedagogy in the 21st Century, Navigating Tradition and Innovation. That will be followed by a panel discussion featuring Dr. Murphy and Ms. Sclafani on the topic of career paths for pianists beginning at 5 p.m. in Roush Recital Hall. The events are free and open to the public. The Western New York Chamber Orchestra will give its first concert of the spring semester on Sunday, February 18th, beginning at 3 p.m. in Roush Recital Hall. Admission is free. And finally, on Wednesday, February 21st, the Fredonia Jazz Showcase with featured artist Joe Granson on trumpet will perform in the Roush Recital Hall beginning at 8 p.m. Admission is free. If you have an arts event you'd like to get on the arts calendar, just call 716-679-1891 with your information or email to operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll include your event. Please give us a month's notice in advance to ensure a timely mention. ¶¶ June always brings to the Opera House the annual Bach and Beyond Festival. But since we can always use more Bach in our lives, two SUNY School of Music faculty members, Lynn McMurtry of the voice faculty and David Rose of the strings faculty, joined forces to bring together an impressive collection of faculty, alumni, and current students to create an event called Bach Together Again, which will take place on Friday, February 9th at 8 p.m. in Rausch Recital Hall. I got to speak with Lynn McMurtry about this event and how it all came together. I am joined now by Ms. Lynn McMurtry. Lynn is on the voice faculty at the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia, and she is part of the brains behind an event that I think is designed to out Bach, Bach and Beyond at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Lynn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Now, I'm gonna let you set the scene for this, because this is this event is Bach Together Again, Friday, February 9th at 8 p.m. at the Rausch Recital Hall. And what really caught my eye here was all of the various elements involved in it. So I'm going to let you speak to that, because this doesn't happen often at the School of Music.
No, and it's really been wonderful to see how it has developed. You know, I didn't expect that it would get this multifaceted. The initial idea was just to do more Bach with, particularly with the voice students who I work with most directly at the School of Music. You know, it's hard to overstate the importance of Bach's music, I think, in the Western classical music canon, and the beauty of it, the intricacy of it, the power of it has always been so valuable to me. And I have some wonderful experiences with that music that I count among my top 10, you know, as a musician, as a performer. And so I wanted more of that music in our students' lives. And a lot of the most approachable music for young singers are the arias from the cantatas. But if you want to really do them, of course, you need not just a keyboard, which is the model that we often use in the voice studio, voice and piano, but you need other instruments. And so I was trying to find a way to develop that and make that happen. So I was envisioning bringing in a guest artist to work with these students on this repertoire. And I mentioned this idea to some of my colleagues, and David Rose, who is our wonderful viola professor here at the School of Music, was really positive about this idea. And it turned out that last fall, he was running his own class on the music of Bach, particularly with a view to the cantatas. And so we were able to integrate our students from the voice area and the instrumental area to work on that repertoire. And then we started to develop a program which would not only give the students a chance to do their projects, but also give us as faculty a chance to do some of this fantastic stuff with each other. And then we thought, well, we need a big choral finale to end the whole thing. And so I talked to Adam Lubke and said, hey, do you think we can bring in some choir? And he was game, and David wanted to start it off with some big orchestral moment as well. So he sourced something and recruited his colleagues on the instrumental faculty. And just really, it just kept rolling and rolling until we had this really wonderful program plan with faculty soloists, student soloists, alumni coming back to join the orchestra for this, the choir singing a chorus. And I'm a little bit amazed, but also highly delighted that it has grown into the program we're going to be doing on Friday.
Yeah, I really want to congratulate you on what you've developed here along with David, because I am, you know, like I said, when I was looking for the events for the fall and getting ready to do, the spring and getting ready to do, you know, my spring set of podcasts, I missed this the first time around. And then I looked again and I went, wait a minute, this program here that they're doing is amazing in its scope. I mean, the performers that you have coming in from the faculty. You've got, Jessica Tong, Isabel Ong, David's going to play, Father Sean Duggan's going to be on the piano, Sarah Hamilton on the oboe, Laura Kepke, you're singing, Joe Dan Harper is singing, Aurora Deeds is singing. I mean, I'm stunned. I mean, it's really quite amazing, and it's got everything. You're going to do sections from the St. Matthew Passion of all things. I mean, that's the work.
Just pieces of it, you know. We're going to have a couple of arias. One of our student sopranos, Ella Monaco, is going to sing one of the soprano arias. And then Dr. Sarah Lubke, one of our soprano faculty, is going to sing one of the other soprano arias from the Matthew Passion. That's one of the great signposts, right, of our Western classical canon. We're going to have some of the real biggies. And then some of these other less known arias, you know, one of the ones that I'm doing, Jesu lass dich finden, I think unless you were really interested in Bach cantatas, you might never have, you know, heard it, or certainly not, you don't think of it. You know, it wouldn't be one of the ones you list if you're listing the great arias of Bach. But, it's a gem. It's such a gem. And, you know, in terms of why I wanted to do this project, it goes back to when I was a young singer. I was a fellow at Tanglewood. I don't know if you're familiar with that music festival. It's the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I was fortunate enough to be a fellow there in their summer program for 3 summers. And in 2 of those summers, they had something called the Bach Institute, where Craig Smith, who was the music director of Emmanuel Church in Boston and a formidable presence in Baroque and classical music generally, ran this institute where he put his musicians from Emmanuel with the students in this repertoire. And so we had this week of exploring these arias with this incredible ratio of students to faculty. I remember these rehearsals where you'd go and it would be like me and a cellist and maybe a harpsichordist or maybe a violinist and an oboe player, whatever it was, you know, just depending on the personnel required for the piece. And besides us, these students, Craig would be there, and Frank Kelly, who was the tenor soloist, would be there, and Peggy Pearson, who's this incredible oboe player, would be there. They're all in the room listening to you rehearse, and then you finish the run through, and then each of them would scurry to their counterpart, you know, and say, okay, I think we should do it this way, and do you think more about this, and I think you should play into that. And then they'd have these arguments. There'd be this conversation in the room where Craig would say, no, I don't think that's really the articulation there. And Frank would say, but you got to let the words do this thing. And it was just fascinating and rich. What a place for us to be. So anyway, that was how I got to know some of these lesser known arias and duets, because they were part of that repertoire that Craig and his cohort brought to us there. And, you don't have as many opportunities maybe to hear them performed, but they have so much detail and interest and variety in them too. And I'm just so thrilled that I'm going to get to do them. 2 violas and 2 oboes in this one that I'm doing, and no continuo, which is super weird.
What?
I know, because it's all about purity. This text is about finding their savior and trying to be without hesitation and without blemish. And Bach chose this idea of no continuo to, you know, suggest that partly on musical terms. And it's so neat. They're so neat. So we're excited.
Well, what an opportunity to hear these. I mean, people wouldn't get a chance to hear these otherwise. That's because they're not often done and they're so unique. That's great.
That's right.
You have a guest artist coming in on the Baroque cello, Christopher Harry Tatos, who, amongst other things, he's been at SUNY Fredonia once, I know, and he is the cellist, both playing modern cello and Baroque cello for the Rochester Philharmonic in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the instrument itself. What does the sound of the Baroque cello add to the whole sense of, doing a whole program of Bach as opposed to anything else?
Yeah, well, this subject, you know, of historical instruments is so interesting, right? I mean, the music stands on its own, of course, whatever instruments you use. But if you start to get more acquainted with the context of these pieces, instruments have evolved over time and have developed to generally be more powerful and produce more sound so that they are up to the requirements of larger performance spaces. If you think about the history of performance, we're kind of moving from, you know, the small chambers in the king's court to larger churches and cathedrals and then more formal performance spaces where you need more power in the instruments. And so many of the instruments that we play now have been designed to make more full resonant sounds. And so these earlier instruments have a different quality. That's not my area of expertise, but there's a different quality to them that is the quality that is the instrument that Bach, for example, in this context, was writing for. And so I'm not a purist, and I don't know if any of us are purists in this concert, but there's a question that is fascinating to try and get closer to the sound world that Bach was writing for and that he knew, and to hear that timbre, which I mean, again, it's not my area of expertise, but maybe you could describe it as a little reedier, maybe, or a little lighter, not the sort of rich, romantic, wah kind of quality, you know, something that is potentially more plaintive, potentially more flexible. Again, it's so much about context, and of course, every performer engages with their own instrument in their own way. But this is the general idea. There's also a different bow, which would have a different quality when applied to the instrument too. So, it'll be interesting to hear how Chris talks about that. We're not all on Baroque instruments in the ensemble. To my knowledge, although they might be using Baroque bows, that's actually a detail that I'm not sure I know for sure. But yeah.
And I'm really interested also in the logistics of this because, again, just to make it clear, you have faculty coming in, you have a guest artist coming in, you have alumni who are coming in to do this concert, and you also have quite a collection of current students doing this. How have you managed to pull all the logistics together to get people to rehearse and so on and so forth?
Well, David Rose has been fantastic at organizing the instrumental colleagues and reaching out to them and recruiting them for this. And the Bach class that he and I did together in the fall helped to gather many of our students. And then just a lot of emails to people, and you know, trying to say with enough, you know, planning in advance, this is when we're going to do it, and come on down. You know, I think really the set of logistics I'm a little concerned about right now is getting everybody on stage in the right configuration at the right time. Because if there are any Bach purists who are going to come to this, they're going to be a little shocked when they hear our student ensembles and see some of the parts being played on marimba, which, shocker, Bach never had a marimba. He didn't compose for marimba, but when David and I were developing this project for his class, the whole point was to use the students who had registered for the class. And there were no keyboardists who had registered, but we have all these fantastic percussion majors because Kay Stonefelt has such a great program. And so we had all these percussion majors who were in the class who we wanted to use. And so there's a lot of creative assignment of instrumentation going on, and we have marimba players covering these parts in the student ensembles. So we got to figure out now, how do we get like the marimba and the cello and the double bass all together for one of those ones, and then one that has a more traditional combination maybe of voice, cello, and violin. And it's going to be a lot of interesting stage management. That's the part I'm really wondering how we're going to work out. We're going to tackle that this week and make sure we know what we're doing there.
Oh, I'm sure you'll pull that off without a problem. You know, the more I hear you talk about this event, the more I keep thinking to myself, and I guess this is, you know, coming from my former hat as a theater department chair, it's like, what a recruiting tool. I mean, you know, this is right in the middle of audition season, and you've got everything there. You've got the choirs, you've got the instrumentalists, you've got the vocalists, you've got faculty, you've got students, you've got alumni. What a fantastic recruiting tool this is. I certainly hope that, you know, students out there who might possibly be listening to this podcast, who knows, but, you know, they'll check this event out because this is an all-in-one package.
Thank you. Yeah, I really feel that way too. We're very excited about it. The next day, Saturday, is an audition day, and we've reached out, of course, to our auditioners. We hope that some of them will come and listen, and we've invited, the area musicians up at the Fredonia Central School and interested in getting them to come as well. It's free, and as you've pointed out, it showcases so many areas in the School of Music. And I'm really excited to have people visit us and see just how many rich aspects there are to what we're doing and how much goodwill and community we are exhibiting in this multifaceted project that requires a lot of different forces at a very busy time of year. And I'm so grateful to David and to all my colleagues on the faculty and the instrumental faculty and the choral faculty and the support of the administration as well to make this an event that people know about and will come and support, because I think it's gonna be a wonderful concert.
Yeah, well, you know, short of Masterworks at the end of the year, I think this is probably the largest event that I can recall in I don't know how many years. I don't even want to talk about how many years that the School of Music has done. So, you know, I have to congratulate you and David and anybody else who thought to put this program together, because not only are you giving the current students the opportunity to experience, you know, get more Bach in their life. Everybody needs more Bach in their life, of course.
Amen.
And alumni to come down from Buffalo and other places to play once again at their alma mater, and all of the faculty that come together to do this. This is, I'm amazed, Lynn. That's about all I can say. You've really, this really done quite a job here, and I hope people take notice, and I hope this is something that you and David and whoever can keep on going, because it just seems like a fabulous event.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And it ain't over till it's over. Let's see how it all goes. I mean, I don't want to count my chickens too soon, but you're absolutely right. We really have a wonderful event lined up, and we're very excited. And I'm just now at that point, you know, where the logistics are mostly going, and most of the emails have been sent, and I'm really looking forward to singing now. I can't wait to get up there and get to sing with my colleagues and enjoy collaborating, especially with my instrumental colleagues who, you know, I don't get to do these kinds of things with them very often. And really, that was one of the original reasons I wanted to do this project too. It's just, I want to sing more Bach with my fantastic colleagues. I mean, any of your listeners who have heard David Rose play Bach know what an incredible sensibility he brings to that music. So just to collaborate with him alone is a great treat. So yeah, it's going to be great.
Wonderful and wonderful. Hey, listen, thanks for talking to me. And especially it's such a last minute, but I appreciate you coming on and allowing me and the podcast and everybody to get the word of this special event out, because I think it's going to be a humdinger. Thanks a lot, Lynn. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Bach Together Again, an evening of J.S. Bach from the Cantatas, the St. Matthew's Passion, and instrumental works, will be performed on Friday, February 9th, beginning at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall at SUNY Fredonia. Admission is free. This is an unusual opportunity to hear some of Bach's less performed music and a collaborative performance you won't want to miss. And that's it for this two-thirds edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Patrick Stokes and Lynn McMurtry for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, please drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, February 21st, 2024. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there. And be kind to one another.